It's the Raven and the Blues on BFBS Radio 2, and live guest. Once again, the studio has got a certain amount of ambient background noise outside, because Heathrow was working hard and so are the Ducks, but it's with huge pleasure I welcome somebody who I've talked about a lot, and I've been so much looking forward to meeting, that's Otis Taylor. Welcome to the Raven and the Blues.
Thank you.
You're in town 10 dates with Gary Moore.
12 dates.
12 dates, of course.
These are the last two.
That's the last two, yes. And we'll come to how that developed. But let's go back to how you started, in a sense. Because you had a 20-year hiatus, wasn't it? Where you sort of...
19, that's
19,
close.
19, yeah.
That's close enough for radio.
It is, that's true. But where people didn't know of your existence, in the sense you weren't playing, you weren't recording, but I've got a feeling you probably were... playing at home or something, if you know what I mean. You were still a musician in the sense.
Well, see, music, there's three things in music. Music business, music performance, and just music. And anybody can play music, you know. You can play it on your stereo, or you can play it on your guitar. I have a Parlor grand piano in my living room since the 70s. So I always have a piano. My kids play piano, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
My banjos hang on the wall.
So, but what was there a conscious decision then, going back to what, the middle 1970s? To quit.
Yeah, I just stopped. I wasn't happy.
Right.
With the music business or being in the band. I didn't need to do it financially because I had this other business and just stopped.
Right.
It's strange to people. How can you stop? You just stop. I know it's a hard concept for people.
And left all aspects of the music.
Basically, yeah. I played one gig in the 80s. Older theater, and that was it.
Was that because you mentioned the fact that you just got sick of the band and things? Was it being in a band, or was, I mean,
just everything?
Yeah,
just sort of too much energy.
But in that
music
time,
business, you know,
yeah. But in that time, though, as you say, you didn't give up music. You didn't give up creating and writing poetry, which had music.
No,
in
you
it.
Always make up things. Yeah. I mean, even Below the Fold, my daughter. Started a song that I made into a whole song when she's about 6 years old, when I go to Santa Fe for business. Because my dad, I came back, my wife goes, "You gotta hear this." She was singing this under the piano. It was, "My daddy's gone to Santa Fe, my mama's here waiting, my daddy's," and I thought, that's incredible. So then we did the Pullman Company with that, you know, because my father used to travel, and so I knew that was like a song. It's been a very popular song on, you know, the internet. People download that song.
And then we get to the 90s, and this time you come back. What was the turning point, the thing which made you think, I'm ready now, or things have changed?
No, it was an accident. I mean, in the 80s I was involved with bicycle racing. We had the fourth best team in the nation. I had African-American kid riders. I had three kids were black that rode for me on and off, and two of them made the national team, A team and B team, which is a big deal.
Are you a cyclist yourself?
Not a cyclist. I coach. I mean, I had that, you know, I was a cycling manager and coach. I don't know. That's another story.
Right. Okay. We'll leave that to one corner then. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I could ride the bike, and they always had to beat me every day at practice, but, you know, that's just a whole other thing.
So,
you know, that's how I got big. Because sprinters were, I had a lot of velodrome racers. So I used to be like, I used to ride a bike at 172, and all of a sudden I started lifting it. Be with the sprinters, and I was like 215, and, you know, pretty big guy. That's when my wife first met me. I was looking good then, a long time ago.
But age is a cruel thing, you know.
No, I'm cool with that. So the main sponsor, Buckner Clothing Stores, Buck Buchanan, later on he went bankrupt, and he opened up a coffee house in the 90s. He called me up by getting a PA system because he knew I knew about music. And I just said, "You're going to open a call. Call some friends and come play for you." So we played. I called Kenny Passarelli and Eddie Turner, and we down and played. And we had, like, Kenny said he had an out-of-body experience because he had retired from music. We all had retired. And then we just sort of started up again. And then I had never made a record. It was like, my whole life, I had never made a record. I was once going to make a record. It didn't happen with Blue Horizon. Mm-hmm. So,
of course, that's going back. Yes, Mike Burnham.
Yeah. It didn't happen.
I've forgotten that, yeah.
And, so I had no evidence I ever really played music, so I made a record. And then my wife said there'd never be a second record. And I made a second, a third, a fourth, fifth, seventh, eighth, and I have eight records now.
So Eddie Turner and Kenny Passarelli, they were just friends of yours, I guess.
Kenny was a good friend.
Yeah.
Kenny was a client.
Right.
Because in the late 70s, he was one of my big clients because he was playing with Elton John, yeah, making a lot of money. And so I sold him a lot of antiques. And so we're childhood friends, you know, at that time. So I knew him from high school, you know. So high school days. We went to different schools, but I knew him since he was 17.
All right. So it was a friendship going back many years and lots of different incarnations.
Yeah. The whole deal about selling something to him was like, well, bring your guitar over and we jam and then some Indian rug, you know. So it's always like music involved about coming over to, you know, sit around and jam. So we had probably been developing this thing for years, not even thinking about that we actually were developing some sound the way we played together, you know.
So when you came to open the coffee bar,
it seemed like you played for years. It was kind of almost like that.
And was it, were you turning to each other and saying, you know, we're going to do this in C or whatever? Or
just about, that's how I always did music. I didn't have too many chord changes.
Right.
Did more covers back in those days, you know.
So the stuff you were doing with Kenny were material that he would know too, then, if that's the case.
Yeah, just certain songs and then things I do, like grooves, I just did songs I knew that I wrote. We weren't taking it that serious at the time. You know?
Yeah, it was just the idea to test the PA system, make sure it worked properly.
Yeah, just messed around. It's like... Wasn't thinking about.
Let's see if we can test my recording system. You've got a borrowed guitar, the Takamine, and where are we going to go with the first number?
Well, I'll start off with a non-blues number because I won't have to bang the strings so hard before I go out of tune. It's on the new album, too, called A Few Feet Away.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Your daughter should be here, shouldn't she?
She's doing her nails at the hotel, taking a rest. I fell down and the moon went out. I'd just be a few feet away from you. The sky fell down and the moon went out. I'd just be a few feet away from you. Sometimes people wonder. Whoa, people stare. Sometimes people wonder, oh, just tell them who I am. We'll go for a walk and we'll sit by the rock. I'd just be a few feet away from you. We'll go for a walk and we'll sit by the rock. I'd just be a few feet away from you. Sometimes people wonder, whoa, whoa, they're still. Sometimes people wonder, just tell them who I am.
Taken off the new album, a track we played a couple of weeks ago, and that performed normally with your daughter, isn't it? She's on back vocals and written for her too.
It's about her, about that.
Does she play? Do you work together in the sense, do you say I've written this, or is it a sort of a team effort, a family thing?
No, I only did one song with her that when she was a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about me,
right? And
she has her own thing. She writes her own songs. She has her own thing that she'll do maybe someday, maybe she won't. So she keeps her kind of thing.
A different thing. Genre as well, I would guess, is it?
You kind of got it there, buddy.
The one word, if you do a Google search on Otis Taylor, the one word, or the series of words that come up, Robert Johnson, John Lee Hooker, poetry. And that is extant in all the work that you've done. Extremely strong lyrics. For anybody who hasn't seen your albums, you don't put lyric sheets on the albums. You put what the song, what the poem is about.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful stuff. Has it always been this way?
Yeah, because I was lazy. Didn't want to write, you know, because I just change the words a lot too. I just thought it's not a lot of words. When I was a kid, when I first heard Mississippi John Hurt, being from living in Denver in the north in Chicago, coming. And he's from the Deep South. I didn't know what he was saying. I couldn't understand him. I asked all the white kids at the Folklore Center, what is he saying?
You know? What you mean?
Because I couldn't understand the accent.
Oh, I see, yes.
Yeah, just like, you know, I can't understand Jamaican accents. I have a hard time with Scottish accents. Some English accents I can't understand. I have a hard time with English not spoken in a Colorado accent, basically. You know, California I can deal with. I get in New York sometimes and get a little... I was in New Jersey once and heard a black accent ask for directions. Said, thought to myself, boy, I've been away from the ghetto too long or something because I couldn't understand them. And I was in New Jersey. Mm. So
the writing, you say, it's just... you said it was lazy. I disagree with that altogether. Isn't it you are doing...
Well, it's conceptual.
Yeah, right.
So it has nothing to do with the words. It has to do with the concept.
Yes.
So if... So the words...
But that's like the African original roots, isn't it, in a sense?
Well, I don't know. I'm a Gruit to tell the story, but I don't know. I don't know how they do it. I never studied how they do it. I just sort of use a few words. I'm just trying to get you the... it's like the relevant if you say fire, and people basically get the point in the right spot.
Yes.
They get the emotional point. So I try to do it that way. I'm like the reverse of Dylan, you know? And then I don't like to have... I just want to have one great line. So all the other lines build up to that one great line, you know?
So yeah.
I've taught workshops on my writing style, but it's kind of unusual, maybe.
I don't think it's not so much unusual. It's just that you are... It's almost like, in terms of modern art, in a sense, in that you don't have to have all the bits in there to understand what it's about. It just requires the feeling and the words and...
Well, conceptual.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Mm. Yes, you see, I had a song on Double V, and it was called Sounds of Attica. But basically, I wanted to write a song with this one word. I decided for Americans of my age, if you say Attica, it gives a total, a whole story comes into people's heads. You know, it's just maybe you say King George or something, and people go, oh, yeah, okay.
Now, Attica was what, 68?
Yes, I can't remember exactly.
No, but around about there.
I'm not
yes.
a great historian.
No.
But it's just the whole thing, you know, see what I mean?
Yes,
I do. There's probably an English word if you just say this word.
No, I mean, conceptual is the word you use, which is the correct one, really.
Mm-hmm. No, English word that must be that if you say a word to England, maybe toast means war. I don't know.
Yes.
You know what I mean? There's a word that probably, I don't know the word in England that kind of...
There are things, though. Attica is a moment in time which struck everybody's memory if you were American.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been things like that in British history.
Yeah, you can just say it.
Yes, I mean, poll tax, basically. Everyone thinks of the riots back 20-odd years ago. We have those seminal moments, really, when something happens and everybody knows about it. I mean, it's been a lot recently here in the UK, and our UK audience will fully understand, but many Americans may not. Princess Diana. I mean, there's been lots about Princess Diana in this last week or so, and that again is a defining moment. So yeah, it's we have them too. Yes.
I mean, if somebody wrote a song that just said Diana, people would probably know exactly visually. They would see that her face.
Yes.
See, so you would already be. That's conceptual. With one word, you can make people see a face.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it.
Mm.
I better write that song. Anyway, but you know, get on quick before somebody steals my idea. But you know what I'm saying?
I do. Yes.
See, so if you just said that. People would see her face, and that would be conceptual.
Some of the words, when you listen to an album from beginning to end, which less and less people do these days because they mix it up on their iPods and things, but on Respect the Dead, I felt a kind of anger. Was I right?
You can feel whatever you're right, because you're supposed to feel whatever you want to feel. See what I mean?
Yeah, I do, yes. But
that's the whole idea. I don't tell people what to think. I'm not a politician. I'm not political. I'm a sort of social commentary, like the news, but it's a lot audio news. And I'm a Groot, and I tell a story, and I let everybody decide what they want to decide.
Right.
See, that's the whole thing.
So if I take away anger and Chris takes away love from the same album, that's okay.
That's okay, yeah. That's how I feel about it, yeah. Totally feel about it. But I'm just trying to keep a lot of these certain stories I'm trying to keep alive, and certain stories I'm just making up.
Do you feel, yeah, that's another thing. There seems to be an element of making sure that the historical side of what happened in America in the 20th century is kept extant and people don't forget it. Is that, again, something?
Well, just because they're interesting, and I do try to. But I wrote a song on Truth Is Not Fiction. It was called House of the Crosses. I don't know if you ever... Did you ever get that album?
No, I didn't, no.
It's a great album. And matter of fact, that album's... one of the songs from the album called Nasty Letters in a movie called Shooter with Mark Wahlberg, which was like, I guess, the number one movie in Australia and number two in Germany or something. And Danny Glover is about a sharpshooter.
Yeah.
But in the House of Crosses, I was in St. Petersburg, and we went on a tour, you know, and they said, this is the House of the Crosses, and it was a prison. Wow, that just sounds so cool. House, you know, because it looks, I guess up high, it looks like two double crosses.
Oh, right,
so they call it the House of the Crosses, right? So next night I wrote this song about House of Crosses. We had a tour guide take me to Hermitage Museum, and I sort of told him the words, and he goes, ugh, pressing. I go, wow, that was cool. I said, now, who's your favorite musician, American musician? He goes, Frank Sinatra. I said, oh, that's right, what the problem is. Because I didn't know why he couldn't. I thought it was very Russian, and that song was very Russian with the cellos and everything. And you know, so sometimes I just make up these things. You know.
Is it?
But it was a very dark song.
Do you have to discipline yourself to actually write, or does it just sort of kind
of... It comes like dreams.
Right.
I have to discipline myself when I have a thought to write it down so I don't forget it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm lazy and I forget great thoughts, but...
So when it comes to a new album, like the new one, Definition of a Circle, it's not like, oh, I've got to write an album, I've got to write some songs. Basically, I've got to write some poems. Basically, they're all done. Is it, or...?
Basically, because I have like a book this thick of lyrics. Mm-hmm. So I'm never worried about songs as much as the concept of the album.
Yeah.
Like, what is a concept? And that's the hard part.
So the album has to have a collective feel to it as well.
I think so. That's what I always... Well, it's got to be different than the last album. It's like a combination. The more you do, the harder it is to be different, but yet the same. So it gets harder. Each album gets harder and harder to make.
Yeah.
Technically, it gets easier, but creativity-wise, it gets harder.
You feel that the person buying the album or your listener has to have something different.
Well, why'd you make it then? See what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean.
So it's got to be different but yet the same, so you don't lose your audience, your fans, but it's got to be like, well, why am I buying this album?
Yeah. Well, you're buying it, though, for the strength of the fact that there is another 10 or 11 tracks, another 10 or 11 poems with music by Otis Taylor.
But some people like you to be a little, like a painter, to be take it someplace.
Yeah, move you on somewhere else.
Yeah.
There's the risk then, though, in some respects, you might pick up some new ones on the way and lose some people.
Well, the object is never to lose any.
Yeah,
and just keep
grab
on
some
picking
new ones.
It's only just keep on picking up new ones.
Okay, let's have some more music, shall we, Wesh?
Okay. So... Being all about me, I'm going to do a Charlie Patton song anyway. Got some pony. Ain't gonna rise, is it? Ain't gonna rise, no, shelling no more. Got a storm pony, ain't gonna rise, no, shelling no more. Got a storm pony, ain't gonna rise, is it? Ain't gonna rise, no, shelling no more, say. Got a storm. Thank you. I stomp on it, ain't gonna rise. Ain't gonna ride no Shetland no more. Say, got stomp on it, ain't gonna ride no Shetland no more. Don't like it, rather gonna show you where to go.
To, I guess, about the 1930s, late 1930s there with that one, I guess. Is it Charlie Patton?
That was real.
Yeah. Charlie Patton, the original side of the blues. And I think something which you have covered at the beginning, that was really where your influences lay, isn't it?
Well, you know what I say, people. Some people have trouble with my music because they think it's sort of avant-garde and out there. But there's a history of people going, hey, man, wow, I'm really into blues now. I was listening to Johnny Lang. Then two ladies later go, oh, no, man, I just found out about Stevie Ray Vaughan. Then 3 years later go, oh, man, I got it now. Hendrix, baby. Hendrix. Oh, and then another year later, oh, I know where Hendrix got his stuff. Muddy Waters. Then they get him, oh, now, no, I know where Charlie Patton, right? Boom. Then they stop.
Yes.
Then you have to go back. Who was Charlie Patton's
influence?
To?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's Africa. You know what I mean? Mm. And people don't seem to make that jump back to Africa.
Yeah.
They kind of just stop, right? Like they freeze in time, right at Charlie Patton.
Mm. Well, of course, it's also
or Robert Johnson, whatever.
Yeah,
you know what
but it's the beginning of the recording industry as well. Because before that, all you could have was written down explanations of kind of what it sounded like.
Well, no, it's been carried through the banjo and the old timey banjo.
Yes, and the Mississippi Sheiks and going back to that, yes.
So it's all there because people still, in the mountains still played the same way in Africa and the field hollers and all the gospel songs that always stayed the same. Gospels stayed a lot the same from the 20s to the 60s even.
That's true, yes.
So it was a recorded, audio recording of Black history. So, I don't know, just everybody stops. I don't stop there.
Mm. But you, a couple of years younger than me, you, in many respects...
Well, thank you, anyway.
I did the research. In many respects...
Couple, I know you're
okay,
being a little stingy with that, weren't you?
Four or five, then. When you were growing up, your formative years, did you hear the blues in your family's house?
My mother played Etta James.
Right.
Like 8 hours straight. All I want to do is make love to you. That's what she did. She'd buy a record and she played it straight.
Right.
So I'd always like that. So when I heard the Rolling Stones version, it was like weird to me. It weirded me out, you know. And but I didn't hear country blues until I went to Denver Folklore Center and learned about folk music.
Yes.
And that's where my really roots started with folk music when I was like 15.
I was
early folky in the early 60s, you know.
That was the time when folk was really moving away. And
it was
also
about civil rights, too, which was really important to me. Mm. So people really took me in. They were like, oh, little black kid, he likes musical. I lived about four blocks from the Denver Folklore Center.
Right.
And I walked by there going to junior high school. That's where I kind of discovered it one summer. It was like a half a block from my route to walk to school and four blocks from my house. I've kind of, all the coffee houses and the beatniks were there in that area and kind of discovered them, you know, kind of rolled in there.
A mainly white area?
It was sort of half, it was about two blocks into the white area.
Right.
about two blocks later, kind of changed on you real quick, you know?
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah.
And so the folk influence then for a couple more years, and then, of course, I suppose all of a sudden it would just
Dylan
all...
and rock and roll.
Yeah, they would just all come together, right now, in a sense.
Well, all kind of together. No, it's like, if you play rock and roll, girls will like you. Okay, I can do this. You know what I mean? So I started changing my... I got freaked out about the banjo because I went to a party with the Dillards. My banjo teacher, Mike Kropp, took me to, and the Dillards met me, and I was playing banjo. Go, oh, you should go down to any of those frailing contests. You could probably win. And I said, go where? And they said something like Memphis or North Carolina. I said, oh, these guys got to be tripping. In the 60s, I'd be dead, and I would have been dead. So then I freaked out and stopped playing banjo. But at the time, I didn't know the banjo came from Africa. I just thought it was a banjo. And I didn't know about banjo history, so I kind of started playing more guitar and harmonica. I became more of a lead singer harmonica player. And then, you know, then later on when I came back to music, then I found out about the banjo coming from Africa.
Right.
Which was sort of a sad story, you know. But I always played the banjo, I just didn't concentrate on it much anymore.
On its historical roots.
I just sort of started getting more into guitar, and mostly harmonica. Nobody took me as a serious guitar player, it's funny. So I just sort of was always like the lead singer, because in those days it was like Tommy Bowen was a guitar player, and I was around all these great guitar players. I just didn't think, play a little Delta guitar, but I just didn't consider myself a guitar player.
Yeah.
Because all these guys were so incredible guitar players, I just didn't. I knew I was a songwriter in my heart, but I didn't consider myself like a guitar player.
You're listening to The Raven and the Blues on BFBS Radio 2, and you're listening to Otis Taylor, our guest this week. Otis is on tour at present in the UK, and in what initially sounds like a really odd pairing, except we played last week a track from the latest album with Gary Moore on guitar, and because you're on tour with Gary, which it's how did that happen? How did they come together?
Well, it's really funny, but I don't think it's an unusual pairing. Because when he plays with me, you can tell on the album, he's right in there with me, isn't he?
And you were actually about 3,000 miles apart, weren't you? As well?
No, I came to the studio and we did it.
Oh, I see.
He did it, yeah.
So I did wonder.
I brought all the tapes over, and but he did it in two takes because he didn't know where the ending was, so it took him two takes. So it was really live.
That explains. You know. I pondered last week on the show, and I said, the thing is, when you look at the sleeve notes, that Otis was in one studio and Gary was about 2,000 miles away in another. So therefore, you know, how did they just sound so perfect together? What I hadn't realized was that, you'd gone down and joined him.
And I wouldn't let him listen to the tapes before he got to the studio.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so how did Gary get involved with being on the album in the first place then? You go back away?
No, I just met him a year and a half ago or so. I was playing in Brighton. It was my first tour over here about a year and a half ago, and it was October sometime, or I can't remember now anymore. And I did get a two-page article in The Guardian, which is a big thing, and that's his paper, and he read it. He goes, this guy's in Brighton, I got to go see him. So that's cool. I saw two guys sitting in the back, looked like musicians. One, he had a friend who was a flamenco guitar player, had Rasta hair, and he looked like, I thought he was, you know, I thought they were like Irish musicians, like Rasta guys or something, I don't know, because they had the Rasta hair, one guy, you know. And so at the end of the concert, you know, I'm signing CDs and selling, he walked up to me and goes, I'm Gary Moore, blues guitar player. That's, I didn't know he was, that's nice, yeah, that's nice. It's like, I was so cool, and he said, this guy, Taylor, is like the coolest guy, like he could care less. And he kept on talking to me, and then he like kneeled down like on the table and started talking to me, and man, he says, you freaked me out. I was like listening to you, and you said, he said, boy, if they just play Slide right now, it'd be so cool. Then somebody played Slide. I like freaked him out. Then like a couple songs, he goes, man, if somebody just play harmonica, it'd be like, and then all of a sudden, like next time I played harmonica, and it was like just freaking him out. It was like, you know, he told me this just freaked him out. It's like every time we thought something should happen in my set, I did it. You know, it's just like, he says, man, I really get your music, you know, because it's very rootsy.
He's
really a strong blues lover.
Oh, yeah,
it's very, he has his own thing that he wants to do, but he really understands and really feels it. You know, and it just, you know, then he gave me his phone number, so I didn't know what it was. And when he left, people go, no, it was Gary Moore, it was Gary Moore. Oh, it was Gary Moore, he's really big. And I found, oh, shit. And then
I be nicer, yes.
Yes, I called him up and said, talked to him. I go, well, you know, I'm doing that. Why don't you come play? And he goes, yeah, I'll play on it. And that was it.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, last spring, was it? Or, I don't know, last fall, was it? This is spring, was it summer? Must have been fall. Mm-hmm. We played at Bush Hall. It was so cute. He says, come on, Gary, will you come up and jam? Yeah, I'll come up and play a song. Okay, just a song. Oh, yeah, cool. So we did sound check, and then we went out to dinner. He sound checks for an hour and a half. It was really funny. He got there way before I got there. He was a guitar guy. And we're eating, he goes, well, you know what? And I can't say blankety blank. He goes, I'll just play the whole set. So I have that. So I have those tapes. And so he played the whole set with me at Bush Hall. Then when I went to Brighton, and a couple days later, he played the whole set with me.
Did you sort of say, ladies and gentlemen, you know, Gary Moore? Or
I did, but no, I didn't advertise it, so nobody knew.
Right.
So you couldn't do that. I wasn't allowed to do that. So people just sort of like...
Turned up
know.
And, oh, look, I was on guitar.
Well, you couldn't miss it. I mean, once you start playing, the volume was kicked up a little more, and it got more aggressive, and it was a cool set.
I would imagine...
And he liked Bush Hall so much when we played there. They went back and did like a promotional thing for the tour, Bush Hall.
Right.
Which is kind of cool.
Yes.
Maybe they'll send me some money.
when he's on stage playing with you, I mean, we'll come to the present tour. When he was on stage with you on the last time, do you have to keep him under control? Or
no, 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 no. No, I'm a big guy. I don't have to keep anybody under control.
So true.
He's very respectful about other people's thing, you know. It's like his thing is his thing, and then he does another thing. He's not like...
And is he playing very, very differently when he's with you on stage as opposed to when he's Gary Moore?
Well, it's a little different. Yeah. It's more freeform, you know. Yeah. So he's just sort of just whatever. You know, it's different, because his show is pretty a show, you know. But with me, it's just you don't know where we're going to go next or, you know. It's just has that kind of energy to it.
Huge buzz for him as well. So we come to the present tour, where you're now support to Gary. I just mentioned 10 down, 2 to go. And by the time you hear this program, actually, they'll be gone as well. Did Gary just call you up and say, Otis, can you come on support on the tour?
Well, I said, but it'd be cool if I could play that, your tour, but well, we'll see. Well, is it really heavy? This is a true story, and you're going to hear it for the first time publicly. I was offered to play the Chicago Blues Festival. So I go, okay, I want to go tour. But could I get off early? He goes, Otis, we're going to advertise this tour. Well, it wasn't a guitar magazine with my name in it. So you got to do the whole thing. Oh, man. And I was going to miss my daughter's high school graduation, Chicago Blues Festival. I was going to ask my daughter, should I go? And that's why they're at the thing. So they can. Yeah. I brought her over as a graduation present. You met her this morning.
Yes, that's right.
And because I missed her graduation. So I brought her all the way to England for a little mini vacation, you know. And so I had to do the whole thing, and literally 3 or 4 days ago, I got a call, and they wanted to play in Boulder for Barack Obama's campaign cocktail party.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and I couldn't do it. It was on the 9th, and I had to turn that down.
Oh.
And I went to Gary. I go, you know, I turned it down last night, Gary, but... you should have went. No, Gary, you know, I know he wanted me to do the whole tour, you know. So it's just like when it rained, it just like this tour was really testing me.
Yes.
You know? But it's been a good tour. It's been sold out, 6 sold out shows and big venues, you know. So it's just sort of funny, you know.
And I think also it's good if somebody calls and says, are you free, Otis? Can you do this? It's going to be a really big one.
Well, that'd be like playing for Martin Luther King. It hurt.
Yes.
I just want to be honest with you. Even for my family, hometown, you know, to be there. With some wealthy people putting on the party, or vacuum people, and my daughter's known because we live in Boulder, but
it may not be the only one he has, though.
Well, see, the whole thing is like the Democratic convention is going to be in Denver, which is 30 miles from me, so I can see how the whole thing was getting set up, you know what I mean?
I do, yes.
And I just wanted to get on that ground floor, you know, because there'd be a lot of people in town for that convention, you know. But that's life, and you just...
Let's hope when you get back, you suddenly find that what goes around comes around, and the second chance kicks in. You know,
people talking about me too because of Gary too.
Yes,
I mean, I got in. What happened was another thing is, like I told Gary, you know, I don't lose perspective. They were doing an article on famous guitar players and their guitars, and somehow I got in that article with like Jeff Beck and it's Clapton. Gary wasn't in that. Jeff Beck, Clapton. Jimmy Page, Fogerty, again, Fogerty.
Oh, yeah. So he's the only American. So
Robert Randolph.
Oh, right, yeah.
Somebody else, and about what our favorite guitars were.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy called me for the article when I was sound checking at Bush Hall, and I go, I only got a second. I'm sound checking with Gary Moore right now. Okay, now I understand this. So the next day, it's in the Society paper, Gary Moore plays in the web Society section.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And somehow the Society people got a hold of it, and then they go, Gary Moore, you know, to see the play with Gary Moore tonight, right?
Yes.
In the Society section. My wife, she's used to work for the newspaper, so at that time she got me the article, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 weeks later, they did a full 2-page article in the local paper on me, period.
Yes.
You know, so you think, you know, all these things, one thing brings you another thing.
Yeah, that's right.
So you can't lose perspective.
That old expression,
people that help you, you know.
One door closes, other one opens.
Yeah, but you can't forget about that when you close that door, the people that helped you.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you can if you want, but it's not my style.
No. You know? Talking of style.
Is that a complex story? Now I don't have to play as many songs, you know.
Not quite. Let's have another song now, though, shall we?
Okay. It's all Louisiana. My soul, Louisiana, but my body lies in Tennessee. I didn't kill no brakeman. I didn't kill no engineer. Well, the white man pointed his fingers and he said, always said, He didn't bother to hang me. He just shot me on the spot.
Amazing, listening to The Raven and the Blues with our guest Otis Teller. You've probably heard lots of planes flying over, and yet, every time you start playing, the planes go away. A magic trick. The one thing, Gary Moore obviously is headlining, is bringing his own fans who've been hanging around for 30 or 40 years. And therefore, what's their reaction been to when you open for him?
CD sales for me has been really high, so it's been good.
Mm-hmm.
We've only got 34 CDs left. Right. The whole tour is really bad.
With only two nights to go. Mm-hmm. Yes.
See, a lot of, I've liked about Gary's fans, there's a lot of young kids, like guitar playing kids. Mm-hmm. So I got exposed to a lot of young kids, English kids, which the blues audience just doesn't have that as much.
No, it's mostly older. It needs to, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I was really happy. I was really, you know, like guys with long hair goes, yeah, I play guitar, man, you're cool. And I play bass, you know, it was like, you know, these young kids.
Mm. Yeah. So moving to, did you hope and expect this was going to happen when you started the tour, or has it been an extra bonus, so to speak?
Well, you hope so. I didn't know it'd be such a younger crowd.
Mm.
You know, I mean, there's older people. There's maybe 10 or 15% is younger. Guys brought their kids, their sons, and stuff like that. It was really cool. I mean, I signed some CDs to some kids who were like 10 years old. You know, like, there were some kids there too. You know,
yes,
which was really nice because that's, you know,
Predominantly white to the audience, or
yeah.
I guess there might be somehow. Yes,
I had a couple of colored sightings. I call them.
Yeah.
Colored sightings, you know. Just sightings of colour.
It's such a pity because so many of the young coloured kids here in the UK have got no concept of where the music came from or anything. And you know.
But that's okay. I don't know about the UK thing. For black Americans, they're always on the cutting edge, and that's what they do.
Right.
You know, blues was once cutting edge. You know, it's just they don't like to go back to the past. They like to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Stay in the future. And even like the jazz guys were always into cutting edge.
That's a good point, I guess. Yeah,
so it's just sort of.
Yesterday was yesterday, and we don't look there.
Yeah, and they don't. But the white people are always looking at what the black people are doing today.
Yeah.
Since the 1700s, playing the banjo, you know what I mean? The minstrel shows, they always copied what the black people did.
Yes.
It's a funny thing, you know?
It is.
And then they study it and go back to the old stuff. And
yes.
I think the English study it the most. They're very academic about the blues, you know?
It's odd because I'm of an age really where it was a very anodyne, the music. I mean, for a start, we didn't have the number of radio stations you had in the States, so we were force-fed one radio network, which played a little bit of pop music, not just different genres, just a little bit of pop music once a week. And it was the days of the Everlys, and we had lots of English artists who were Pat Boone sound-alikes and things. So it was part of
colonialism, I call it.
Yeah,
take their culture and run with it like the Romans and the Japanese do. That's what the English do.
And as we said before on the other interviews, it was the people coming in, the sailors. It's all the sailor ports, London, Liverpool, Newcastle, was where the records came in from the States.
Yeah.
And then that's where the club I went to, played blues, and that's how I discovered it. And it was just so raw, so strong, so vibrant compared with everything else.
So un-white, that's what it was.
I don't know at the time. I mean, we had the blues guys came through as part of the folk and blues overseas tours. So I saw Sonny Boy Williamson and John Lee Hooker and things. But I don't think at the first time I heard it, I thought, "Oh, that's black." It was just more a matter of it was just so raw because most of the bands who were doing it, I had no knowledge of the history of the time in a sense. Yeah. It was just something so exciting for many people. The Rolling Stones and the Beatles were the first time they heard something so full of energy. You know?
Yeah.
And of course that was distinctly non. It was distinctly very white, basically, yes. Where to now, after the tour is over?
Go home for a little while, go to Florida. It's on my website, otistaylor.com. Then I go to Latvia in July and Prague and France.
Normally on your own, or the trip with your wife? And
I'd be like my cello player and my daughter playing bass, maybe a drummer from some of the
tours. Yes.
otistaylor.com.
Yeah.
But that's changing every day, too.
Also, there is something I found when I was doing the research. The Otis Taylor Street Team.
Yeah, join it, I guess. You know.
How did that start?
Well, everybody has America's street teams. It's a very American thing. Yeah.
Oh, right. Which is the idea behind it is they, as soon as they join the team and as soon as something new occurs, they get told and then they spread the word.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the first time I've heard of that.
It's a very Grateful Dead-like thing.
Is it?
Jam band thing, yeah.
Ah. Oh. Showing my lack of knowledge. Okay. How long has that been running?
About a year or so.
Right. Yeah. Anywhere exciting coming up?
Going to Tunisia, I think, but I didn't post it yet because it's a 99% sure. Well, what is 90? It's like, this is like June something.
Yeah.
I got to play Tunisia on the 13th. Well, when has it become 100% sure? You know what I mean? You know,
I said, Tunisia.
Well, oh, geez, we must go on vacation Friday. You know, I have a French agency. So we'll talk to you Monday, you know, so I don't post it until I get... But it is 99% sure.
Tunisia, great stopping-off point, though, for Mali and places like that.
I'm not going to Mali.
You're not?
I'm barely going to Tunisia.
I see.
I went to Turkey. I don't do too much third world.
No. Okay. I just with your interest in the...
The interest stays
in the roots. You don't want
to... I just like to watch it on video.
You don't want to do a Taj Mahal and go there.
And I have a bad stomach and just... traveling is really hard on me.
Right. So,
So it's the foxes and the crows, you said?
Yeah, the crows. Yeah, better explain. If you're listening to this conversation thinking, well, where are we up to now? Before we started recording and doing the session, Otis and I sat and had a chat. And it's on a houseboat on the Thames. Many of you have seen the photographs. And on the outside deck, we've got a few plants and plant boxes. And we had a duck who decided it would be a great place for a duck nest, which, of course, is a good idea in a sense. You know, you're off the ground and everything else. Except the foxes, the first year, took the eggs. And so now we lift the steps of the top deck up. We winch them up out of the way, thinking she was safe. So come to 2007, and she lost 8 eggs, I think, and then one day the crow discovered them and took them away one at a time. And so we've got a very sad duck on the top deck trying to work out where her nest has gone. Hence the conversation.
I'm going to try to write a song about it. It's a duck, right?
It's a duck.
It's a duck. Got a sad duck. I can't keep her egg. Can't keep her eggs. Got a sad duck. Got a happy fox. Got a sad duck. Got a happy fox. Got a sad duck. Got a happy fox. She say, Mr. Fox, she say, Mr. Fox, don't take my egg. Got a happy fox. Got a sad dog. Got a happy fox. Got a sad dog.
Wonderful.
See? I'm just a creative kind of guy, huh?
That's Sad deep, Ducks and Happy Foxes.
Song. That was one of my deeper songs I wrote. You know,
great stuff. For the last 50 minutes, you've been listening to the words and the music of Otis Taylor. You can find his website at otistaylor.com. It's been so good to see you. Next time you're through London, we'd love to see you again. Otis Taylor, thank you so much for being on the Raven and the Blues this week.
Thank you. Otistaylor.com.